All right. Hello, Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we're live in the Skyline Studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, on a Thursday morning. Welcome. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Coming up a little bit later on, Chris Bowden and Joe Brand from Blackhawks Crazy Podcast right here at WGN Radio are going to join us. Just talk a little bit about the possible return of the NHL and the Hawks and all that kind of cool stuff. We always play some classic Johnny Carson. You can watch the Johnny Carson Show on Antenna TV every night. And we're going to play back Politician Lie Detector, which is a bit that is going to be very funny. We're also going to be talking about great backyard games and feral chickens are plaguing a New Zealand town. So we're going to talk about incidents that we've had with animals or wildlife, things like that. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you want to join us. We're talking TV. If you got any TV questions or anything like that, join us. Dan Feinberg, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. He joins us biweekly to talk TV. There's always a lot of TV to talk about, and people are stuck inside. Want to watch some TV? And we'll tell you about some of it. And here is Dan. Hi, Dan.
How you doing, Nick?
All right. How are you, sir?
I appreciate our biweekly visits because it means that one day out of every 2 weeks, I know what the day of the week is. So I'm feeling pretty good about this being Wednesday into Thursday.
That's exactly what it is. Well, I'm glad we can organize a little bit of your life like that. So anyway.
Just a tiny bit.
Check out The Fine Print. And he covers it, The Fine Print. That's F-I-E-N. There's always a lot of TV to talk about. First of all, did you see the season finale of What We Do in the Shadows?
I did indeed. It wrapped a very, very good season.
A great season. I just love that. I don't want to give anything away, but I just love the how much Guillermo kicked ass in the episode. I was just thrilled by that. I don't know.
It was a good resolution to kind of the arc out the season and to where they left things at the end of last season. I am very disappointed that it's over for, I mean, heaven knows how long at this point, because you know, maybe they're in a writer's room right now online working on season three, but it's going to be a long time, and definitely, you know, every little glint of light for the past couple weeks or the past couple months, it's been good to have that for 22 minutes.
I agree. I totally agree. It was a show that you could just laugh for half an hour and just forget about everything else and just laugh. And the cast is so funny. Everybody in that cast is hilarious. And I think the writing is great. And I think they did a great job. And I love the movie. And I was kind of like, I don't know how they're going to be able to make a series out of this. But they did a great job. They went in kind of a different direction, and I think it's great.
I still prefer the movie because I still just think it works better with the tone. But I think they've done so many good individual things this season. I mean, not just the Jackie Daytona episode, which we've talked about before, but I think what they've done with the character of Colin Robinson season has been tremendous. Just a good season, and if people haven't watched, they can definitely catch up on two seasons worth on Hulu, and that's a good way to spend a handful of hours.
Absolutely, and it'll take your mind off of things too, because it's just a funny, funny show. And again, I thought they wrapped it up great. I thought the finale was fantastic. So, all right, and I'm glad it's, and I'm sorry it's gone as well, Dan. You know, I felt that way at the end of Zoe, at the, you know, the Extraordinary Playlist. I was like, what? This is a show that made me feel good for an hour every week.
And it's too bad, because it's not like there aren't good things, and it's not like there haven't been good things that have been premiering lately, but most of them, at this point, nearly all of them, have been on the streaming services, so they're binge shows, and if you have no particular restraint when it comes to watching those shows, they're gone in 2 days.
Exactly.
So it was always, you know, I'm not one of those people who feels like every show really and truly should air every week, because that's how buzz builds and all of that. I think some shows are really, really good in, you know, binge doses, but you know, there's just a pleasure that in the past couple months in particular, I've been able to get out of weekly shows. Like, I mean, even something like Top Chef. When Top Chef is over for the season, I'm going to be so sad, because I have needed that show every Thursday night.
Yeah, and I love this season. It's a, you know, it's an all-star season. Are you rooting for anybody particular?
I think think I'm rooting for Kevin. I think my instinct is just to root for Kevin. But on the other hand, it's a good final group. I've been impressed with sort of how Stephanie's arc has gone this season. I'm hoping that Champagne Padma comes back, because Champagne Padma is the best. No, they've just done so well this season. And once again, just having that show, even with the number of different prizes that they've had to have been tied to things that don't actually exist anymore.
Like, I know.
Go to the premiere of Trolls 2.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Go to the Olympics.
Yeah.
No, guess not.
Yeah.
But even with those things, that show has been a lifeline. So, you know, once those shows are gone, it's really just stuff. It's the weekly dose of John Oliver. It's Desus and Mero. Those are the things that are going to be keeping me going,
yeah.
I think.
Well, I mean, Top Chef this season has been so much. I'm rooting for Melissa. I love Melissa. And
no, Melissa's fantastic. And I think it would be Melissa versus Kevin for, you know, whose restaurant I would want to eat at. But,
yeah,
you know, whichever Voltaggio it is, he makes good food. I would eat what he makes. You know,
yeah,
I've been to his brother's restaurant.
Oh, have you?
It's really good.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Well, that's Top Chef, and it keeps me going. I watch it Friday mornings. I watch it every Friday morning when I get home from work. It's the first thing I do is watch Top Chef.
I couldn't wait that long. I buffer 15 minutes so I don't have to deal with the commercials, and then I just watch.
Yeah, okay. All right, listen, why don't we take a quick break? There's a lot to talk about here, Dan, and there always is. And we got a couple of listener questions already. So hang on, Dan.
Excellent.
Hang on.
Sure.
There's Dan Feinberg is with us. He covers TV for The Hollywood Reporter, and he joins us biweekly to talk TV. And we'll talk that some more. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio on a Thursday morning. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Dan Feinberg, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, joins us biweekly to talk TV. Always a lot of TV for Dan to talk about. And hello, Dan.
Hello, Nick.
We have a listener question that says, what's the status of Bye Bye Birdie with J-Lo?
Oh, we ask NBC Brass about that one every time we get together for TCA Press Tour. But because TCA Press Tour for July has, along with everything else in our world, been canceled,
yeah,
we will not get the chance to to do that this year. NBC has had a string of live shows that I was really, really looking forward to seeing them try to do that simply have fallen apart for various and sundry reasons. So
yeah,
this is one where it's just sort of in limbo, because they had J-Lo doing all sorts of different things. There's World of Dance that she does. There were three seasons of Shades of Blue, a show that some people, I suppose, remember existed. And
yeah,
so it kept getting pushed back. They said they were going to do Hair. Then I think at a certain point they realized you can't really do Hair as a live family-friendly musical.
Right.
They were going to be doing a live stage show of A Few Good Men, and they boasted for a couple of years they were going to do that. And I'm pretty sure Alec Baldwin was going to play Jessup, and that was going to be cool, but
wow,
then that got put on the back burner. So the answer is that I don't think they've said for sure that Bye Bye Birdie with J-Lo is dead, but you know, it's all just in spinning around in circles,
yeah,
and I would love to watch it, so I hope they find a way to make it happen, but I'm not holding my breath.
Have these live musicals done well in the ratings? Are a lot of people watching them?
They've had a mixed report, honestly, and so, you know, obviously the first one was Sound of Music, and it was a huge hit, and everyone was like, yay, and then they did Peter Pan, and it was a disaster, and everyone was like, oh, boo, and then they did The Wiz, and it was successful, yay, so it's up and down, Fox has had a real roller coaster. They did Grease, it was a massive hit, then they did kind of canned versions of Rocky Horror, and that was a disaster, and it was just awful. Then they did Rent Live, which was a big old mess and didn't do very well. So there's always value to a successful live thing on television, because that's the thing that you do that actually gets people in theory to watch live, and you stick commercials everywhere and you make a ton of money off of it.
Yeah.
But they've become so hit and miss. ABC had a lot of success with Little Mermaid. It did reasonably well, so they're going to probably do things of that ilk. Everyone's trying it, and no one is saying that they're done with that kind of thing. But obviously, at this point, you know, there was the Disney sing-along that ABC did two different versions of last month, and those did fairly well. And those weren't exactly live, but they were live-ish. Yeah, there's value in these, and we'll see. I mean, we'll see once this all ends if live theater is still a thing that people are doing. And maybe under that circumstance, exactly the perfect thing is to be doing live shows without an audience that people can all watch together, but no audience. So
yeah,
we'll see. I mean, yeah.
I remember really enjoying Jesus Christ Superstar.
Jesus Christ Superstar was a success. It was nominated for a bunch of Emmys. It was, like, I'm not a big fan of it as a musical, and yeah. I thought that was a great production of the show.
Yeah.
So, but then Fox did whatever that strange Easter Passion thing that they did with Chris Daughtry and a few other people, and that was a big ratings disappointment. So for every single one that works, there are at this point about two that aren't as successful, which for contemporary TV is not a horrible ratio.
Yeah.
And so I assume they'll keep trying once the world gets going again.
You know, by the way, you mentioned John Oliver. You know, he's great every week. He's fantastic every week. But this last episode was unbelievable. Really, really unbelievable.
He so clearly felt that the week before, because of the shooting on Saturday, and that's a horrible word choice on my part, because of the fact that they shoot episodes on Saturday,
right?
They were a day behind on all of the stories about the protests and the arrests and just all of the chaos that was happening. And you could tell how bad he felt that they had missed that, and
yeah,
how much genuine anger he had built up.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was, this week's episode was very powerful.
It was, absolutely. Okay, quiz. Let's talk about that.
Actually, an entertaining TV show that people can watch, and an entertaining TV show that exists in three very easily digestible episodes, the first of which premiered last Sunday, the second will premiere next Sunday, and the third the week after. It is a British-produced show, but airing on AMC, and it's the story of, if you happened to be in England, a famous and notorious cheating scandal involving the original incarnation of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire.
Okay.
And it stars, among other people, Matthew McFadden from Succession and Sean Clifford from Fleabag and the great Michael Sheen playing the host of the British Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. And it's directed by Stephen Frears, and it's based on a stage show, and it's just an interesting look at kind of the illusion of competition television, of game show television, the suspension of disbelief that we have to do at home to believe that everything is on the up and up, the suspension of disbelief the producers have to do to believe that their show is perfect and infallible and cannot be cheated upon. And so it takes a case that initially seems very cut and dry, and that certainly, as reported in the British media when it happened and when the trial happened, appeared to be very cut and dry, and is just really interestingly pragmatic and intelligent and fun about it. And so it's amusing. It's sort of very behind the scenes TV fun. So if you're kind of into the origins of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire and how they rigged up the suspense of all of it, it's a great look at that. It's not as good as Quiz Show, at the movie Quiz Show, which is pretty much the definitive depiction of game show cheating out there. One of the great movies, honestly, ever. It's truly one of my favorite movies.
Yeah.
But it's fun and it's interesting and it's consistently compelling, even if you think you know what the result of the whole scandal is. So it's I recommend it, and it's also short. It doesn't overstay its welcome, which so many things these days do.
That's true. So it's called Quiz. How did it end up on AMC?
It's an ITV show from the UK, and AMC was the American partner that got in on the action. They saw the potential of it. And so, you know, could obviously just as easily have ended up on HBO or something like that. And it has that feeling. But, it was produced for ITV in the UK, ITV, which was also the network that aired Millionaire in the UK and that also aired a wildly successful documentary by Martin Bashir about this cheating scandal as well. So the British audiences can't get enough of it. This was a massive hit in the UK when it premiered earlier in the spring.
So you mentioned the great Michael Sheen. How much fun is he in this?
He's a ton of fun. It's very much a supporting role, and I think he's so compelling that once you spot him in the ads, it's hard to take your eyes off of him. He's got, you know, very, very blonde hair. He's got bleached eyebrows. He's talking out of his nose, a very nasally proper voice. He's just such a fun actor to watch going, and so many actors would be afraid to go as big as sometimes he goes.
Oh man.
And he has no fears whatsoever about chewing scenery, and he's having a lot of fun here.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's one of the things about Michael Sheen that's so much fun, is just like he'll do anything. You know what I mean? He's he will chew scenery and steal scenes, and I love it every time he does it.
He is incredibly talented, and then every time you watch a performance like this and see how big he can go, it's always important to remember Masters of Sex on Showtime, which was a remarkably internalized and small and intense performance.
Yeah.
So he really can do anything he wants to. He just obviously gets a lot of pleasure out of this sort of hammy role.
Yeah. All right. That's the great Michael Sheen. And this airs on, what night does it air on AMC?
It airs on Sunday nights, and, you know, it might be just as well if people want to wait a few weeks and binge the whole thing, but it's also fun to watch on a weekly basis as well.
There we go. And that's called Quiz. All right. If you have any questions about television, Dan Feinberg is with us, 312-981-7200. The phone lines are open, 312-981-7200. And, Dan, lots more TV to talk about. Hold on.
Excellent.
Okay, Dan Feinberg from The Hollywood Reporter is a TV critic. You can check him out at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. If you have any questions about television, 312-981-7200. The phone lines are open, and we will take your questions about TV coming up. It's Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN. We're live in the Skyline Studio here until 4 a.m., keeping you company, keeping you informed, and keeping you to get through this. We'll do it together. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Coming up in a little bit, we got Chris Bowden and Joe Brand from Blackhawks Crazy Podcast. And we're going to talk a little bit about the return of NHL, hopefully, and more. It is Dan Feinberg. He's a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. He joins me every other week to talk about TV. And our phone lines are open if you have any TV questions. 312-981-7200. Hello, Dan.
Hello, Nick.
All right. Let's talk about Dirty John, the Betty Broderick story. I've been seeing a lot of commercials for this.
Indeed. This is, like Quiz, another based on fact limited series. This is somewhat inexplicably the second quote-unquote season of the Dirty John franchise. The first season was on Bravo last year, starred Connie Britton and Eric Bana. It was based on a very particular case in which the male antagonist was nicknamed Dirty John.
Yeah.
The new season has absolutely nothing to do with him, because why would it? It's not like he's a returning character who features in other people's narratives. So they just decided to graft on the name of one sociopathic con man onto a story about something completely different and call it a franchise.
It's weird how they do that. And this has become a trend, Dan, because we were talking about it. I remember when you talked about Penny Dreadful. And
Penny Dreadful made more sense, though, because that was fictional and it was sort of a fictional universe.
Yeah.
Two real horrible cases in which people died,
yeah,
and to yoke them together as a as a fact-based limited series brand, to me, is kind of gross as heck. But, you know, what do I know? You do you, NBC Universal, but no longer on Bravo, because Bravo had a brief window where they thought they were doing scripted programming and then shrugged and said, okay, whatever. And so it's now on USA, a cable network that happens to also be somewhat moving out of the scripted programming business. It stars Amanda Peet as Betty Broderick, who some people who remember things from the late 80s, early 90s will remember killed her husband. And the case was a notorious piece of national news because, like I said, she killed her husband and his new wife. And it became a commentary on institutional sexism in the law and also gaslighting as a concept. And it became a successful television movie starring an Emmy-nominated Meredith Baxter. So this is a second version of that story. It's 8 hours. Unlike Quiz, a show that I just mentioned, doesn't overstay its welcome. This one probably does not have 8 hours of story in it. Probably not anywhere close. But, you know, what it does is it reframes the story of Betty Broderick so that Betty Broderick is front and center, and so that she's not just the woman scorned or the reactive homicidal spouse. She is a woman of some psychological complexity, and Amanda Peet is really excellent playing her. Amanda Peet is an excellent actress who, for whatever reason, Hollywood has rarely known what to do with, but anyone who saw Together, her show on HBO, anyone who saw Brockmire, of course, she's great. So, yeah. And you've got Christian Slater as her husband. He's fine. He smirks a lot. That's what he does. It's not much of a character, but, you know, if you say Christian Slater smirk, he's good at that. Rachel Keller, who some people will know from the second season of Fargo and from The Society on Netflix and from Legion on FX, she plays the mistress slash second wife, and it's a utterly thankless part for her. I hope she got a good paycheck because she's third billed and has nothing to do. And there are some interesting storytelling things that it does in trying to get into her head. And then there's just a lot of tawdry sub Lifetime material that's spinning wheels. Sometimes I thought it was effective and interesting. Other times I didn't know why it was doing what it was doing. None of the supporting characters register in the slightest. Betty and her husband have four kids. You'll come out of this not knowing any of their names because presumably none of them wanted to actually sign over life rights. So they're basically four supporting ciphers in the background. But, you know, it's not awful, and there's something to be said for enjoying a good tawdry true crime drama in times of difficulty. I just wish it could have been better or differently focused, and I still don't understand why Dear John is a franchise.
But okay.
Not for me to know.
Okay. Well, are the same people the creative force behind the first season of Dirty John in this?
Alexander Cunningham is the franchise's runner. She was the showrunner on the first season and the second season. The first season was directed entirely by Jeffrey Reiner, who directed none of this season. The season's directors are all women, which probably is a smart and good move. But Alexander Cunningham is the primary creative force. And, you know, I can see the things she's doing. And I can see the effort she's trying to make to move a misunderstood woman into a realm of being understandable. Just wish it was done with a little bit more fluidity.
Okay. All right. So that runs on Tuesday nights, correct?
I believe so. And it's 8 episodes. And I think we're 2 episodes in now, maybe 3, because I think they might have done 2 episodes the first week.
Okay. There you go. So it's Tuesdays at 9 on USA. And that's Dirty John, the Betty Broderick story. Are they going to continue to do Dirty Johns now? Is that what's going to happen?
They haven't announced a third season yet. And of course, state of the world, as we like to say, they're presumably not going to, but I feel like it's actually doing fairly well. People do seem to be talking about it at least a little. So it wouldn't surprise me. I wish there were a way they could do it without branding it this unconnected kind of icky thing. But at this point, it's now become a brand for them. So, yeah, I would guess that they'll try doing it, except that, again, if some people are moving away from scripted programming, which of the NBC Universal family of networks is going to want to air it? Maybe it'll be on Peacock for season 3. Who knows?
Okay. All right. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you want to join us, if you have any TV questions. We got some TV questions coming in. We're going to get one question that just came in we're going to get to a little bit later. But 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Dan, have we lost track of exactly how many streaming services there are now?
I certainly have. I can't speak to anyone else. The confusion surrounding the launch of HBO Max 2 weeks ago probably raised the bar on botched launches, because this was a property that, by rights, people should have been really excited to have, and people should have been like, yes, I can't wait to explore it. And people who have actually gotten into it seem to be enjoying what they have to offer. But for 2 to 3 days, all I was seeing anywhere was people going, do I have it? Do I have access to it? How do I get access to it? Someone help me? Why is no one explaining to me? Such bad communication,
yeah.
Corporately. And so I think we're going to get more and more of that as we add more and more. I think we are 3 weeks away from watch Peacock. Peacock's coming soon. That's
right.
The next one is NBC Universal's Peacock, and everyone will have access to that because it's free. So yeah. That one's easy.
Okay. All right. Now, Tom, you have HBO Max, right?
I do, yeah.
How do you feel about it?
I told Dan on the phone before we brought him in, I'm giving it an 8 out of 10 right now.
Wow.
I'm pretty impressed.
Yeah.
Save for the user interface is, like many streaming services, unnecessarily complicated,
mm-hmm.
and poorly thought out in terms of what they're pushing. You know, the first thing you see on a screen should be important and should be tailored to you, and it should be not stale every time you look at it. Right now, they're kind of pushing the same 20 movies. You know, a lot of their bigger properties, you know, they got the tab for the Harry Potter collection because they have every Harry Potter movie. It's Warner Brothers. So that appears on there. A lot of the DC stuff. But if you take a moment to look, there's a treasure trove of great, great, great shows and movies as well, because they do have the Turner Classic Movies collection.
Mm-hmm.
So you're getting stuff like Casablanca, Maltese Falcon. Even some stuff that appears in the Criterion collection, like Rashomon by Akira Kurosawa.
Right.
So there's a lot of really great stuff. Titanic is on there, which I recently did a 180 on. But
yeah, he watched it again, Dan. Now he loves it.
It's a well-made movie. What was not to love or what was not to like? You know, I understand not thinking, you know, not needing to see it 50 times, you know, when you were 12 and, you know, falling in love with Leonardo DiCaprio, but as an actual movie, it's a very impressive piece of filmmaking.
I'm not crazy about it until it hits the iceberg, and then the last hour of it is great.
The last hour is spectacular.
Oh my
but
God.
I think it's pretty impressive before then as well. I think it sets the stakes. It establishes a handful of characters who you want to see either survive or freeze to death. It does the things that you need a movie of that size to do, so that when it gets to the last 30 or 45 minutes, you are cheering to see if someone's gonna survive. You are cheering when a bad guy dies. You're sad when people die. It plays very, very solidly. It is both old school filmmaking, but also, because it's James Cameron, it's, you know, remarkably wildly ahead of its time,
yeah.
Technologically.
I will say this, though. I've always said this about Titanic. There's a genius bit of storytelling in which James Cameron tells the story. In the present day stuff with Bill Paxton and Gloria Stewart, there's one scene where they show you exactly how the ship sinks. They tell you exactly how it happens. They show you how it goes down. They explain everything to you so that when the actual sequences happen at the end of the movie, nobody has to stop to explain what's going on. And I think it's brilliant, because everybody in the audience knows what's happening to the ship, and nobody has to stop, you know, because sometimes you have to, you know, explain what's happening, why the boat is doing this. Never had to stop. It was just nonstop all the way through. And I thought that was, like, brilliant that they did it that way.
James Cameron is a great filmmaker, and it makes me sad that he has decided to apparently dedicate the rest of his life to Avatar sequels that lots of people don't really particularly want.
Yeah, nobody wants an. I don't know anybody who wants an Avatar sequel. I know it's. Is it still the biggest movie ever? Is it still the highest grossing movie of all time?
Oh God, I think it still is, because the amount it made internationally was insane.
Yeah,
and so it, like, just unbelievable the amount it made internationally.
It's amazing that is, like, the biggest movie ever made and nobody talks about it.
Are we adjusting for inflation?
I guess. You can't adjust for inflation because it's Gone with the Wind.
When you adjust for inflation, there is only Gone with the Wind, and that is fine. But no, it made a ridiculous amount of money, and they've been talking about sequels for years, and they're making 4 sequels or something to that effect.
Yeah, something.
I'm not sure I know anyone who wants one.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree. Okay, Dan, hang on.
Sure.
Dan Feinberg is with us. If you have a TV question, you can give us a call. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. And more with Dan Feinberg. Lots more TV to talk about. And again, your questions are welcome. All right. Hey, it's Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN. Live in the Skyline studio. And we're here until 4 a.m. And the news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. And coming up a little bit, our good buddies Chris Bowden and Joe Brand from Blackhawks Crazy Podcast are going to join us to talk about the when and if the NHL is going to return and the Hawks are going to play. They've proposed something. We don't know. There's no time frame on it yet, but we'll talk a little bit about that. We're also going to talk about some great backyard games. And we want, what are your favorites? And feral chickens have been running around in a New Zealand town, which the prospect of that terrifies me. So we're going to talk about our little moments with animals. But right now, it's Dan Feinberg, who joins us every couple of weeks to talk TV. He's from The Hollywood Reporter. It's always a lot of TV to talk about. If you have any TV-related questions, you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Hello, Dan.
Hello, Nick.
All right. Let's continue, shall we?
Sure.
All right. How about Lenox Hill?
Lenox Hill is an 8-part documentary series on Netflix that premiered on Wednesday. So today where I am, yesterday where your listeners are.
Got it.
And it's very, very straightforward. It's 2 filmmakers had access to basically 4 doctors over the course of a year at a major hospital in New York City. 2 of the doctors are high-ranking doctors within the neurosurgery departments. 2 of them, one of them is an ER physician, and the other one is an OBGYN resident. And it follows their lives over a year, follows the cases, follows the highs and lows. Both of the 2 female doctors are pregnant as the series begins. Whether or not that's bad casting or not is something else, because it gives them fairly repetitive narratives involving, oh, look, it's another ultrasound, and et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, that's how the filmmakers ended up with things. And it's just solid. It's not great, but it's suspenseful in that way that decent medical things are. They had a lot of access in surgery rooms, so there's a lot of intracranial surgery that you get to watch, and if that's the kind of thing that makes you go, ooh, fun, then you definitely want to check out Lenox Hill. And if it's the kind of thing that makes you go, ooh, gross, then you definitely don't want to check out Lenox Hill. And that's a pretty clear determination. You know, it's basically the world at this exact moment. People are talking about how great doctors are, thanks to, you know, our coronavirus COVID-19 situation. And this was obviously filmed long before that. But it's for the most part, is watching 4 fairly good doctors try their hardest to be good doctors. And there's something reassuring about that. The drama is mid-range. It's not overly exploitative in terms of its drama, but you know, you'll get emotional at places. You'll probably cry at certain places because, you know, people are getting difficult diagnoses and they're with their families and loved ones and they're trying their hardest. And that makes it tough to watch if you happen to be vulnerable to such things. It's not mind blowing, but it's fairly well timed, and at this point, content is king. And so, if you 8 hours of a solid medical docudrama sounds good, Netflix has got it. Lennox Hill.
It's Lennox Hill. Yeah, I don't do well with medical stuff.
Then entirely skippable because. I think it's decent. That's about all. Some of the storytelling parts of it annoyed me, but it's definitely not like so great at any one thing that I'm going to say, God, you just got to get over that. You got to watch this. It's not that good.
Okay, so that's Lennox Hill, which is streaming now.
It is streaming now. All 8 episodes, in and out, pretty easy. They tend to be 47 minutes to 50 minutes, which at least is not abusive in length, and I'm appreciative of relative restraint. And there's a lot of story. There's a lot of patients. Some of them are traced out over the full 8 episodes, so you actually genuinely do invest in whether or not their treatments are working. And some of them have cancer, and so it's tough to watch. And some of them are having strokes, and it's tough to watch. There's a lot that's tough to watch. But if you like the heroism of doctors trying to do their jobs, it covers that reasonably well.
There you go. So that's Lennox Hill, and it's on Netflix now, streaming. So there you go.
Indeed.
All right. Listen, what about I May Destroy You?
I May Destroy You premiered on HBO last weekend. It is a 12-episode, half-hour show, but it is really a drama, so don't let the half hour fool you. And also don't let it fool you that it comes from Michaela Cole, who some people will know as the British auteur behind Chewing Gum, which was on Netflix for a long time and now apparently is no longer on Netflix, which is bad timing because a lot of people are going to be checking it out because I May Destroy You is getting some very strong reviews. And I think as many people will find it unwatchable as will love it, but to me, it is so clearly an example of seeing an emerging voice and being able to go, okay, this is a person who has something to say, and I want to watch what this person has to say. Mm-hmm. And I will want to watch what she has to say her next show, and I figure for years in the future, it is definitely, if you find Lennox Hill tough to watch, this one is significantly tougher to watch. It's the story of a young British woman. She's a novelist, a writer, like Michaela Cole, played by Michaela Cole. And in the first episode, which is the only one that airs, she's trying to meet deadline on a book. She's got a boyfriend in Italy she's fighting with. She's got friends she's bickering with. And she goes out with friends one evening and can't remember what happened that night. And begins to suspect that she was sexually assaulted. And so the series kind of goes from there as partially a mystery and investigation, partially a puzzle. There are certain things that she can't remember, but she has a cut over her eye. She took out a certain amount of money from an ATM, so there are the pieces of it that you're trying to put together. As the title indicates, there's an aspect of potential revenge drama, but it's also about her trying to bring her life back together and trying to find her voice. And it's occasionally funny. It's very, very funny about the self-obsession of social media and how it makes stars, sometimes just stars in their own heads, but stars. And Michaela Cole is a really compelling actress to watch. She has a very distinctive voice. And this is a show that feels very current. It feels very generational. It feels like it has a certain under-the-surface rage that I can see, that I can see on Twitter, that I can see on the news. And so even if it's not about, you know, protests against police violence or the coronavirus or any of the things that are actually dominating our genuine news, its sensibility and its approach feel very 2020. And even in the parts of it that I didn't think worked as well, I wanted to keep watching to see what the story was going to be. Now, HBO is airing this weekly, and again, it's 12 episodes. My recommendation to people who asked me on Twitter last week is to watch it in mini binges, to wait a couple weeks and watch maybe the first three or four all in a pile. Then at that point, if you know, need to watch every week, you should. But I don't think it works as well in half-hour doses. I think it probably works well two episodes or three episodes at a time.
Okay, so that's the best way to watch it. And where did she come from, Michaela Cole?
Her family is from Ghana, but she just has come up through the British television and theater system. I believe she was a theater student and did theater, and Chewing Gum was her first show that she created. She created this one. She also co-directed most of the second half of the first season. Sam Miller, who's a regular British director, largely of dramas, largely of thrillers, directed the first couple, and that sort of points you in the direction of what the tone is. And this is wildly different from Chewing Gum. Chewing Gum was a raucous sex comedy. So, but you know, it is based somewhat on her own sexual assault and her own coming to terms with that. So there are autobiographical elements, and you can, you know, it feels like a lived experience, and it feels raw and exposed and confessional. And again, it doesn't always work. And some of the deep, you know, the wild variations in tone, some people are just not going to want to deal with it. It's very graphic in its treatment of sexuality, and some people are not going to want to deal with that. And, you know, I understand that. I just think this is one of those things where you can watch it and you can immediately go, okay, this is something we need to pay attention to.
Yeah. All right. That sounds great. I May Destroy You, which is airing on HBO. And again, you suggest watching the first like three episodes together.
Yeah, mini binges, because certainly the first episode, it barely gets into the series at all, which is obviously what she wanted to do. I just think it probably, I don't know if 12 episodes at once is a good idea, because it's intense and it's a lot. I mean, I watched it on screeners over a day and a half, and that felt like a lot.
Yeah.
I think it probably works well in mid-sized gulps rather than a full binge, but also rather than weekly airings.
Okay. All right, there you go. Okay, Dan, hold on.
Sure.
Okay, Dan Feinberg is with us. We talk TV every couple of weeks. You can follow him on The Fine Print. That's F-I-E-N, F-I-E-N, The Fine Print. If you have any TV questions, we can get you in here. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. 312-981-7200. We got the news coming up.
It seems like only yesterday I gazed through the glass.
Yeah. Hello. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we're going to be talking with our good buddies Chris Bowden and Joe Brand from the Blackhawks Crazy podcast right here on WGN Radio about the possibility of the NHL resuming and get to see some more Blackhawks games. We're going to talk about our favorite backyard games, and we got a feral chickens running around in a New Zealand town. And I don't know why that cracks me up. It also terrifies me. But we're going to talk about our encounters with animals. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Dan Feinberg is hanging out with us, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. He joins us every couple of weeks to talk TV and other things. And hello, Dan.
Hello, Nick.
All right. Let's see. Here's Gary on WGN. Hi, Gary.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead.
Yeah, I had a question. My question is, there was a show called Lincoln Rhymes. I think it was The Hunt for the Bone Collector. It was on Friday nights on NBC.
Yeah.
And I haven't heard if it got renewed or not. So I wondered if you would happen to know.
Unfortunately, I have bad news, Gary. It was actually canceled this week after one season.
Oh,
shoot.
Yeah.
That was good. He used to be on Grimes. Or that Grimm's. Yeah, Grimm.
Yeah.
So I was hoping to come back. Yeah. Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay. Yeah, I remember when we reviewed that. That's another one with a misleading title, right?
Oh, just a wretched title. I don't know why they didn't just call it The Bone Collector. That's what the movie was with Denzel Washington. Yeah. It had things about it that were decent. Russell Hornsby is a great actor, and he will do many, many more things because he always works and is always good in things. But yes, I think that NBC killed that one with a bad title, bad promotion, and they simply were unable to make people understand, hey, this is a franchise that you actually might like. And so, unfortunately,
yeah, okay.
One and done for that one.
All right. So in the news, Dan, this is, obviously we're in a very weird time right now. But
true story.
Cops has been canceled. I didn't realize Cops was on for 30 years.
It's sort of come and gone, and it's been in different locations. There were all those years it was on Fox, obviously, and that's the thing that people knew it from. It was most recently on Paramount Network. But yes, Cops, 25 seasons on Fox, X number of seasons on Spike, however many seasons on Paramount, many, many episodes, and now canceled.
Canceled for amid the protests over police brutality, they've canceled Cops. They also canceled Live PD.
And so those are going to be two very different things, because Live PD, not a show I watch, but that was a show that was both wildly successful for A&E and was filling many, many hours of A&E's schedule.
Yeah.
So that's one where it's actually going to, I don't want to say it's going to cripple A&E because A&E will probably be fine, but in the short term, it's a kick in the gut to A&E.
Yeah.
The cancellation of Cops is just like, okay, I can't believe that show is still on, and God, that show did so much damage when all was said and done to the idea of police work in this country and the sheer amount of dehumanizing that show did over 30 years in various different homes, borderline reprehensible, but it had a long good run and couldn't have ended at a better time.
Yeah. Well, you think it's a good move? Obviously you don't like the show, but do you think it was a good move in this current situation?
Oh, for heaven's sakes, yes. And it also would have been a good move any of the other countless times that we've dealt with police brutality in the news in those 30 years. It's a show that could have gotten pulled any number of times because nothing it was doing on air was actually good for society. I think one can argue that there have been things that Live PD has attempted to do, changing its focus to first responders lately, et cetera, where you can sort of see something different that they're trying to do. So I'm that is not a show I watch and not a show I've honestly ever watched. So I can't get into its quality, but I've definitely watched over the years enough Cops to know that that was a fairly toxic television show.
Okay.
And that the reasons why people watched that show, they mostly involved random dehumanized people getting beaten up by people in uniform, and always seemed gross to me.
Okay. And now, the other thing here that's happening is that HBO removed Gone with the Wind in this current situation. How do you feel about that?
It was HBO Max that pulled Gone with the Wind. As Tom was saying earlier, their Turner Classic Movies selection was remarkable, and one of the featured titles was Gone with the Wind, as we established earlier, the highest grossing movie of all time,
right,
when adjusting for inflation. My problem with it is, on a basic level, is Gone with the Wind a movie with a genuinely retrograde sense of race, and is it extraordinarily difficult to watch at times in 2020?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah.
Of course it is. I also do think that in its finer moments, it is utterly stunning filmmaking. And, it is a production of the size. Titanic is an example of a production of comparable size, but there are more than 5 or 10.
Yeah.
Now, to me, the reason why this was baffling is that it's not as if Gone with the Wind became racist this week. It's not
yeah,
as
yeah.
if it suddenly started making people cringe last month.
Yeah.
this is a movie that has always been difficult to watch.
Yep.
And that includes when it came out. So I don't understand how they were not prepared with a title card to go in front of it, like Warner Animation does, like if you look on Disney Plus,
yep,
they do it with Dumbo.
Yep, yep.
Why was there not a card that went up on the very first screen that says, this is not, this is not a 2020 production.
Yep.
There are things in this that are disturbing. If you look down on your screen, we're giving you the option to also watch a documentary featuring scholars and people talking about why this is bad, but also maybe why it's important. It can be both of those things. I don't know why they weren't prepared for this, and I don't know how they got caught flat-footed and actually had to pull it. I don't know why there wasn't a button they could push that triggered the card in front of the movie that says, this is bad in certain ways. It was made in 1939. It was bad then. But come on, different eras. It's a part of film history. Right. And that's where I feel. And similarly, I feel like Disney Plus should have Song of the South.
Yeah.
I mean, Song of the South is a much worse movie than Gone with the Wind. It's not even like, you know, we're talking, But to me, to not have that movie as part of the Disney collection is pretty much just denial of who Walt Disney was.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
He wanted to make Song of the South so badly, and he wanted to make it as the movie it ended up being. Removing it from the Disney collection is removing a piece of Walt Disney's legacy that just because Disney doesn't like it doesn't mean it wasn't true.
Right.
And so,
Okay.
Yeah, I just think acknowledging film history is important.
I gotcha. All right. Really quickly here, Steve. Hey, Steve.
I just wanted to answer on the phone. Is Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist coming back? Did they have enough recorded?
It is. The first season was what they finished, and it's what aired already. So the first season is done, and that is what it was always going to be. So this was not one that got cut off. They haven't renewed it. I have to feel honestly that given that they did cancel a couple shows earlier this week, they canceled, as we said, Lincoln Rhyme, The Hunt for the Bone Collector, and they also canceled Perfect Harmony, the Bradley Whitford comedy.
Oh, right.
So there's part of me that wants to feel optimistic that they could just as easily have rolled Zoe up and just canceled all three of them at once, and instead they didn't. So that leads me to hope that they're trying to find ways to bring it back. So that's what I'm saying is that I have to feel like they're trying, and maybe that's one where they're going to like hold out hope until Emmy nominations, and maybe that's the kind of thing that could boost it. But no, it has not been renewed or canceled.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Steve. Dan, always a pleasure, my friend, and stay safe, and we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Same to you. Talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Okay, buddy. Dan Feinberg, everybody. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we return, Chris Bowden and Joe Brand are going to join me. They're from the Blackhawks Crazy podcast here on WGN, and we're going to talk hockey and the return of the NHL.